Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Back to school season will soon be upon us, a time of anticipation and anxiety for students and teachers. Every year brings not just a new crop of kids, but new expectations from parents and administrators, new ideas around how to teach, including the ever-growing role of technology. Then there are the old, long-standing debates over policies like homework, standardized testing, and the structure of the academic day. Today in The Exchange, we go back to school with a panel of New Hampshire teachers, and let's hear from you. What's your big back-to-school worry this year? What are you looking forward to? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four teachers with us. Thomas Ames, fifth grade teacher at the Indian River School in the Mascoma Valley Regional School District. He's been a teacher for 9 years. Tom, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. I'm honored to be here.
Also with us, Tara Colum, seventh grade teacher at Laconia Middle School and a teacher for 25 years. Tara, welcome.
Good morning.
Also with us, William Murphy, high school social studies teacher at Hanover High. He has been a teacher for, wow, Bill, 57 years. Thank you so much for your time.
Great to be here.
And also with us, Selma Naka-Hoff. She's a high school English teacher at Central High in Manchester. She's been a teacher for 40 years. And Selma, good to see you. Thank you also for your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, Selma, I want to start with you. So before we jump into all these issues, just give us a little bio of your school, how big it is, what the demographics are.
Oh, I'd love to. Central High School is located in the center city of Manchester, and it culls from a very diverse background. Currently, we are at 1,600, and these include the more affluent section of Manchester, inner city. We have a smattering of the suburbs as well, and a very interesting and elevating immigrant and refugee population. We're a comprehensive high school, and we try to meet the needs of all of our students every day.
A big, diverse city high school then, and a little different for you, Tom. Tell us about Indian River School.
Yes, quite a bit different. Indian River School has about 400 students. It's the middle school for the Mascoma Valley Regional School District. That's a district of five towns, Enfield, Canaan, Orange, Dorchester, and Grafton. It's very culturally homogeneous, actually, quite compared to some districts down in Manchester. It's adjacent to the district that Bill teaches in, but socioeconomically, it's worlds away. It's a 5-8 middle school, and it feeds directly into the high school, which is next door. We have two elementary schools.
So small, rural, and a fair bit of poverty? Is that what you're saying?
There's a fair amount of that, yes. Some of these kids are on the school bus an hour and a half each way.
Wow,
that's how big the district is.
Gee, okay. So, Bill, Hanover High.
Hanover High School, located in Hanover, New Hampshire. We have about 750 students. What is significant about Hanover is that we are an interstate school district, so that we were created by an act of Congress, New Hampshire Legislature, Vermont Legislature, and then the U.S. Congress had to approve.
Okay, and you learn something new every day. I did not know that. So you were created by an act of Congress because you pull students from two states?
We pull students from Norwich. We also have other tuition students who will come in from schools in both New Hampshire and Vermont that have no high school, and if they have choice, they can come to Hanover. We have obviously Dartmouth College, and we have the main campus of the Dartmouth Hitchcock Hospital just across the border in Lebanon. So a lot of the people, the parents, will be sending their kids to Hanover. So people will say, oh, you teach in a special place. Well, maybe I do, maybe I don't. But if I say something that is meaningful, I hope it works for you as well as for us.
So it's not as elite across the board as people might think of Hanover High.
I don't know whether I'm saying that, but what I'm saying is that we certainly have problems that and aspirations that we would like to improve on.
Well, Tara, how about you at Laconia Middle School? Give us a little bio there.
Sure. We are in Laconia, New Hampshire, which is about the center of the state, and we are in the beautiful Lakes region. Our school is 6th, 7th, and 8th grade that is fed in from three elementary schools in our district. We have about 400, under 500 students in our building, and we have a growing population of children that struggle with socioeconomic issues.
Well, we had a whole panel discussion yesterday, including some folks from Laconia who talked about
yes.
kids struggling with parents who are abusing drugs and having to take care of younger siblings. And so I'm sure we'll get into some of that
Absolutely.
Trauma that students are facing. But
yes.
I just wonder, Tara, what's sort of on your mind, on your heart as you approach this first day of school?
Sure. I think we're lucky to be in a profession that we get a fresh start every year in many ways. So we do get to redo the things that we maybe didn't hit quite right, but expand on the things that we love to do. So as far as academics, we're always looking forward to that, but teaching has become much more than academics. As you were discussing yesterday with some of the teachers and the administrators that you had on, we are struggling a bit with all the things that kids bring with them to school, you know, on their minds and what their daily lives are like. So some of the things that I was thinking about were things that had to do with attendance, getting kids there excited to learn and wanting to be at school. Sometimes that's a struggle when kids are having problems at home, even though school is their safe place. It's hard to keep that exciting and keep that going when they're worried about, you know, where they're going to go home tonight to sleep, or, you know, if they're homeless, if they're struggling with a parent that has drug issues and so forth. So it's really become much more than academics. So it's always about making connections with kids and how can we make learning exciting so that they know that education is their way out. It's their ticket to a better life. So,
what changes have you seen, Selma, over your 40 years in teaching? And you can answer it any way you want, you know, in terms of the students and some of the challenges that they bring, or just the way we approach teaching or the expectations. Just what broad changes have you seen over your long career?
Well, you know, I think I would like first to begin with our society. What changes have we seen in our society over these last 40 years? Schools simply mirror that. Whatever is happening in our greater community happens in the schools. If there is an opioid crisis in the greater community, and it's not limited just to Manchester, then obviously we have to deal with that within our schools as well. If there's turmoil and lack of civil discourse in our greater community, we see that reflected in the classroom. So, you know, what has changed? Life has changed, basically. And the schools are a dynamic place as well, because we have to change along with what our students are facing. In high school, we have each student for, you know, less than an hour a day. So for 23 hours, they're doing something else and they're experiencing something else. So how do we make that hour, or often less than an hour, relevant to them? I think that's one of our greatest challenges, but it's also what education is all about. I would hate to think that what I was doing 40 years ago is what I'm doing now, because the world has changed so greatly. Yes, there are electronics, and they love to fidget with those things daily. Not always on task, but that's a reality. You know, technology is not going away, especially the kind of social technology that we see very, very regularly. But I think that each day we try very hard to make certain that what we have to offer is something that's relevant to our students. And
well, and a little bit later, I definitely want to ask all of you how you integrate technology into the classroom and how you avoid it being a distraction, not being used in positive ways. But to you, Bill, I think, as we said, you know, you've been in the public school for a long time. What sort of thoughts do you have as you approach this new year? I love what Tara said about this is a profession where we get a fresh start every year.
Oh, absolutely. Before I do that, I'd like to make the observation that for those educators out there, love your spouse and do something special before the year starts, because the school is going to start. You're going to get sucked into the life of the school, and it is going to be difficult on the spouse and the family. So enjoy them now in these last,
That's good advice.
last few days. The other thing that I would say is that if you don't like school now as an educator, you probably should be looking for another job. This is the greatest time of year to return to school and see the excitement and life of the students. It is just rewarding. Sometimes in the past, I've asked teachers, what is school like? What is teaching like? And I like the phrase, it's a fountain of youth. I go back each year and you get reinvigorated. So somebody asks me, well, you've been teaching this. How old are you? And I say, well, I'm only 23. And they say, no, that can't be. And I said, yes, it can. I can prove it. The kids were 16 when I started teaching. I was 23. The kids are 16 when I go into the class this year. Therefore, I must be 23.
So, Tom, how about you? Now, you came to this profession relatively recently compared to everybody else on this panel. What are your sort of concerns, hopes as you enter into this new year?
Yes, I definitely feel like the relative newcomer in this group. I'm always excited at this time of year. People may think that teachers take the summer off and kick back, but I think most of us are actually thinking about exactly what Tara was talking about, is how are we going to do the next year better? And it's very exciting. I spent Monday at a workshop with the Fish and Game Department because I do a trout in the classroom, and it's always exciting to get with teachers from all around the state who are
trout
gearing up for
in the
that.
Classroom.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's something that our Fish and Game Department takes care of, and they're a wonderful resource for teachers, by the way. It's stark contrast to the end of the year when I'm looking back and thinking about all the things that I didn't get done, and I'm sort of, you know,
my slumped
shoulders
over.
Shoulders are sloped there. My situation is a little bit different here because even though I'm in a middle school, I'm really still teaching in an elementary model. These are fifth graders. So I have them for 6 out of 8 academic periods, one of those being a study hall. What I'm seeing more and more is anxiety among these kids, and I think that feeds back to this lack of civil discourse that we've been experiencing lately, as well as the opioid crisis and all these other factors that are going on in our society. And so these kids are coming to school with a lot on their shoulders, and there was a phrase in yesterday's show that really touched me, which was emotional contagion. When they bring that to you and you're trying to help them get through the day, it kind of sticks with you and builds up over the year. And it's really difficult when a kid comes in and things are going really badly at home and they're having a tough time functioning in the school that day. So you got to love these guys. You absolutely have to fall in love with these kids, and you can't fake it because they have to know this. It has to be the refuge that from everything else that's going on.
It seems like you're saying, you know, even just in your 9 years in the classroom, that more than ever you need to love them and
yeah.
let them know.
Mm-hmm. The measure of anxiety actually is in the increasing number of special ed kids that are coming in with special education plans or 504 plans, accommodations that you're making in order to deal with all of this anxiety that they're bringing with them. and how that's interfering with their learning.
So much more to talk about. Let me invite our listeners to join us as well. The number for you to be part of our conversation is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, we're going back to school. We're sitting down with a panel of New Hampshire teachers about their hopes and concerns for the coming school year. And let's hear from you. The number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. What are you worried about during this back to school season? What are you looking forward to as the school bells start to ring across the state? 1-800-892-6477. We'd love to hear from you. Selma, I can see you want to jump in, and then Bill. Go ahead.
I was just wanting to discuss a little bit further what Tom said about special ed IEPs, 504s, and we see an enormous number moving forward, and obviously we make those accommodations, and oftentimes many of those accommodations can really be used for the entire classroom and not just those one or two. The second part of that, though, is how do we prepare these kids for life beyond a classroom where there are so many accommodations? That is really a constant concern of mine and many of my colleagues, because, you know, life doesn't always have accommodations. We don't always have extra time to do things. So there is this dichotomy in what we do, how to meet their immediate needs and how to prepare them to go beyond the walls and all of this very, very nurturing environment that is part of schools and really part of the reason that they come to school.
That's a big question. Bill, you want to jump in, too, on the point that Tom and Selma were making.
I was back with the previous point. When I started teaching, the school was perhaps two-thirds to a half the size. We had a principal who had a secretary. We had a assistant principal who was also the guidance person. We had a secretary. There was a librarian. There may have been a nurse. There may have been a speech pathologist. Everybody else in the classroom, everybody else in the school was a full-time classroom teacher. Now, if you take a look at the school, the largest department in the school is special ed, trying to work with the needs of the kids. And to go back to the point before, I see three. The business, I label it with 504, the specialization of the treatment of special needs kids. And then there's the technology. I can go back to the Ditto machine if anybody else goes back there. Or for that matter, writing on the board the test. And then I think also the huge strides that women have made in the schools.
Some of the changes you've seen.
Yes.
You know, I keep saying we're going to talk about technology in the classroom, and we will after a short break. But before that, Tara, go ahead on this issue that your colleagues have raised about more and more kids needing special education assistance.
Sure. Well, I think it goes back to what Selma was saying, that it's really beyond the school even. It's what we have to offer now, not just in special ed, but we have after-school programs. We have a Boys and Girls Club, and we have a mentoring program. But then we have things outside of our school that are there to help families. Recently, we have the Belknap House in Laconia that is really not just for Laconia. It's a county place for homeless families to be able to go to get assistance, to get back on their feet, not to just live there indefinitely. It's how do you get back on your feet and get going again? And so it's not just school, it's our whole community.
Making those connections.
Making those,
right. And we touched
yes.
on that yesterday, too, in our
right.
program. We will talk a lot more after a short break, including technology. Also, whether your schools do what's called tracking. That means grouping students by perceived ability. All that coming up, plus your phone calls at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's back to school time, and we have a panel of teachers from around the state talking about their plans, their hopes, their challenges for the coming year. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Our teachers are Thomas Ames, fifth grade teacher at Indian River School in the Mascoma Valley Regional District. Also, Tara Colum, she's a seventh grade teacher at Laconia Middle School. William Murphy, he's a social studies teacher at Hanover High. And Selma Nakahoff, she's a high school English teacher at Central High in Manchester. Again, you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, before we go to our listeners, let's talk a little bit more about technology. And Selma, I think I'll kick this off with you. How important, first of all, is technology in your classroom?
Well, as I said before, schools are a reflection of what is going on in society. Society is technology-oriented, and so unless we do that, we are not meeting the needs of our students, and that's our first and foremost aim. So technology in the classroom, being an English teacher and steeped in the humanities, I love a book, though I have a Kindle. Computers are a very integral part of what we do. I do like, however, to stop at a certain point. While I utilize our Google format, we have computers in every classroom, as well as several computer labs and Chromecast carts and all of that. The challenge is to not have a student look at that all the time. Rather interact with one another. And I think we were all talking about some of the other skills that we have to continue to stress, and just discourse among our students is essential. So yes, I utilize the classroom technology, but I also require that students participate in discussions, and that they work in groups.
And that they look up from their screens every once in a while.
They must.
So here's a question. We did a whole program on teen reading a couple months ago, and the experts who joined us said, while a lot of adults are using their Kindles and so forth, a lot of teens actually prefer paper books. I wonder what you've observed as a high school English teacher.
I think a little of both. There are some who really, really admire books. And of course, I admire them for doing that. But the Kindle is also quicker. Every other year, we have a huge book sale at our school, and it's so interesting to watch students actually look through books and just amass quite a stack. And these are kids who probably don't even have books at home. You know, most of us grew up with reading. We were read to as we began. We read ourselves at an early age, and we are lifelong readers. These kids don't know anything about this. As I said, our diverse population, and Tom, you're addressing that as well. They don't have that resource at home. So they look at a book as if it's, I don't know, a treasure. And I have to admire that. But then again, they're always doing the clicking and whatnot on their own devices.
Well, I'd love to hear from everybody on this, too, so I'll just go around the room. So, Tom, how about you? Sort of, and Selma's sort of taking us there, so let's go there. Technology as a useful tool, but also as a distraction in the classroom.
It is definitely a useful tool. Fortunately, we have the computers are either in a cart. I think this year I'm getting 10 full-time computers in my classroom, which is great, but they only come out when we're working on something that involves a computer. So there's not this sort of being glued to it all the time, which is very helpful. We have a Google system, a Google Docs system, so that kids can write on that, which is great. I can look at what they're doing. I can comment on it live. And part of the attractiveness of that is that kids can go home and log on and continue to work on that work. But as you say, that's not a level playing field because many of these kids don't have the internet at home, if in fact they even have a computer at home.
Right. In your district, where you said there's definitely some, you know, some poverty. And also, I have heard that in rural pockets like where you are, the internet access isn't great.
Yes, that's absolutely true as well. They may have the computer, but they're still getting it through their phone line or something like that, yes.
How about you, Bill? How do you approach this issue of technology as a tool of learning, but also a tool of distraction?
If any of my students are out there listening, they're probably laughing at the moment.
Really? Why is that?
I don't necessarily make as much use of technology as some of the others would. I'll comment, for one, about the research paper. I teach the research paper in the school. We go into the media center, and we're blessed with a lot of print resources. But if I say, you've got your subject, now do your research, they immediately go to the computer and hit the computer. And the problem with that is that little of it's actually vetted. So we as teachers have to teach them to do that. And that is difficult. If I want them to use a print source, I have to specifically require it.
You have to provide it.
I have to say, you've got to use a book out of the library.
Right, right.
And then one of the other things that I'm slow on is Schoology. The program is there so that on the computer, so that the homework is there. They can take quizzes on it. They can communicate back and forth with the teacher on it. And a lot of the instruction can be done over the computer. And a third one I would say is, I won't tell you the story that got me across to how much the technology is out there, but I like to have the iPhones or whatever it is there. I always purposely forget what our ranking was among world armies at the outbreak of World War II.
So they looked that up for you.
Oh, bing, bing, bing. Another story. They say, how old were you? How old are you, Mr. Murphy? I say, I was born the year of the hurricane. Nobody ever knows that. Now, with the computer, they say, oh, you were born in 1938. How did you know that? They have their very quick on that.
So how about you, Tara? How do you incorporate it, and how do you keep it from overtaking what you are trying to present?
Well, we do have computer labs, and we have something we call the COW, which is computer on wheels, that we get to bring into our classrooms. Not all of our classrooms have computers.
So they're not all right there, because in some districts, including Concord, almost every kid has a computer.
No, we do not. We have computer labs in our buildings, however, that we're able to sign up for and use. We have cell phone rules so that we have to keep those in place. Having middle school kids just have their phones out to be able to use them for technology can pose a problem. And I would say that, again, as Bill was saying with the research, that it's an issue with teaching kids how to do proper research. A few years ago, the social studies teacher and I did an integrated unit. And so kids were doing research on a social studies project, but then the written part and the actual research paper was for their language arts grade. And we had one girl that was doing something about the Underground Railroad, and she saw Freedom Trail on the internet, took all of this information, and ended up doing her research paper on the Freedom Trail in Boston. So it was totally off topic. She had done the research, but it had nothing to do with the Underground Railroad.
It's a skim job, isn't it?
It was really. So those kinds of things are really, I think it's important, and also to get kids to get to the public library and use a library card and know how to access the library.
Go ahead, Selma, and then let's go to our listeners.
You bring up, Tara, I think skirting an issue that is very, very much part of what we do, especially with this technology and research. Obviously, it's a very integral part of our coursework, but we are really fighting what we adults term as plagiarism, but which students do not. And they access any website. Despite the fact that we try to show them through the research process how to find the legitimate ones and to avoid those that aren't, and they don't understand why they can't just use it. Well, it's there. Well, yes, it is, but those are other people's words and ideas.
That's media literacy, and we've talked about that a lot on this program. Yeah. Bill?
Well, it's building on that, I call a scissor and paste job. They'll go to a source and they'll take out a paragraph, and then they'll go to another source, take out a paragraph, they'll go to a third source, scramble the three sources and change a word and say it's theirs. No. That's
you can
not
smell
yours.
A cut and paste job probably a mile away. Yeah. All right, Tom, I can see you want to jump in.
I'm just saying how easy it is to detect that. You just take a piece of what they've written and put it in a Google search, and there it is.
So technology works for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to the phones. Hear what our listeners think. Again, back to school today in the exchange. What's your big back to school worry? What are you excited about as school begins to open across the Granite State? Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And let's go first to Christy in Exeter. Hi, Christy. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me. So I found this technology question really interesting about how do you use it proactively in a good way and how do you avoid kind of those bad habits. And I work for an online school in New Hampshire. And so where our entire school is online, we also have this kind of yin and yang of working with technology.
So you're at VLAX, I'm guessing, right? Christy, Virtual Learning Academy?
Yeah,
the charter school, right.
Yes, thank you. Yes. So we really work to talk with our students about, you know, what are the positives and really be honest and have a conversation about what are the challenges and work to develop those habits that help promote using technology kind of for good.
I wonder what you think, Christy. I have heard some studies suggesting people retain information better on paper, you know, by writing it down and reading it on paper. Now, obviously, you're at Virtual Learning Academy, so I'm guessing you've thought about this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you that so many of my students that I've worked with take notes still. That's a very common practice with a lot of our students, that reading information and then writing it down absolutely improves retaining information.
Okay. Christy, good to hear from you. Thank you for the call. Good luck with the new school year.
Thanks. Bye.
And up next is Dave in Bedford. Hi, Dave. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. It's a pleasure to talk to the show. I have a question about the evolution of kids' reading preferences, and maybe more for Ms. Nakash than others. But what have you noticed over the years in terms of literature that kids liked, that are staples of, you know, the canon, that they don't like anymore? And what did you like teaching when you first started? And maybe you don't like it so much anymore, or maybe something has supplanted what was really great for you to teach when you first started out.
Wow, Dave, this is a great question. And it'd be fun to dig into that for a whole hour. But go ahead, Selma. What was sort of the stuff every English teacher had to teach 40 years ago when you started? And what's kind of fallen by the wayside?
Well, first of all, I would say, and that there are many questions here, and I'm not sure that I can address all of them, but I shall try. I think that we have to keep in mind that literature, my field, is enduring. And if there is a book that was written 100 years ago, 150 years ago, and it still informs human existence today, then we use that book. And there are several that fall into that category that I have been teaching for 30 years, 25 years. And each year, it informs us in a variety of ways. I can name a few.
Yeah, please do.
Madame Bovary, for example. Mid-19th century, sounds as if it's like, you know, not much there. But as far as language, that's one level. The imagery is amazing. And the message about a woman's role and choices for women. We're talking, you know, 150 years later, and those questions still exist. The concept of crime and punishment, for example. A crime is easy to commit, and it's done in a very short amount of time. And the punishment lasts forever. And these are all lessons, David, that we still can learn from on a daily basis. Now, are there other more current things that we also integrate into the curriculum? Of course there are. We have an alumna of Central High School who recently published a memoir. And that is now a required reading for our students because they can identify with the likes of Gloria Norris, who grew up in a project, who his family was dysfunctional if there ever was one, although I think all families are somewhat dysfunctional. And yet she has risen, and our students learn from her as well.
Tara, go ahead.
I think that over the course of my teaching career, seeing what J.K. Rowling did for literature as far as getting kids to read was incredible. However, I still believe that kids need to read a classic. At seventh grade, we have our great books, and we have certain books that every kid has to read, along with what we found very helpful is doing historical fiction novels with social studies so kids get a better picture of the story of history.
No, I love the question, Dave. Thank you so much. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Here's another question for all of you, and we have done entire hours of programming on this. We won't do that today. But standardized testing, and Tom, I'm going to turn to you first. There's been a lot of talk about this in recent years. What tests do your fifth graders have to take in terms of statewide assessments?
You name it, we take it. That's a glib answer, but we were a number of years ago identified as a focus school, a school of concern, and largely that's a measure of the disparity between the IEP low socioeconomic kids and what the higher kids are achieving. The gap was too large, which is kind of an odd situation to find yourself in. What do? Teach the faster students more slowly to get the other ones to catch up? I mean, it's kind of ironic there. But as a consequence, we are constantly feeding data to the state. That's starting to change a little bit. There are some good aspects to this situation. We've actually devised a specific period in our day, a remedial period, that has really started to close this gap quite a bit. We call that the task period, and I can't remember what it stands for. But so we take the NIWI test.
I haven't even heard of that one. I've heard of NECAPs. I've heard of PACE.
Well, NECAPs, of course, is gone because that's been replaced by the SBAC, the Smarter Balance.
Right, associated with Common Core.
Which gets us into that whole Common Core challenge right now. We also do DIBELS monitoring for reading. This is just a reading fluency and retention test. We do DRAs. This has been one of the core issues in our district. We all agree we do too much testing. What we can agree on is which tests do we eliminate.
Do you feel, Tom, I've heard this from other New Hampshire teachers, that the state and the federal government have given schools assessment whiplash? You know, let's do NECAP, let's do PACE, let's do Smarter Balance, let's do the SAT. I mean, which one do you do?
It's not so much assessment whiplash as standards whiplash. Mm-hmm. We had our state standards for many, many years. Then, after a while, the state finally decided we were going to adopt the Common Core. Our district spent tons of money on new textbooks, and now Common Core is going away.
All right. I'll get all of your thoughts on standardized testing. Also coming up, homework yes or no. That's another biggie. And, of course, we'll take a lot more of your calls, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. It's back to school time today in The Exchange. We're sitting down with four public school teachers from different communities, and we'd love to hear from you. We're talking about some of their hopes and concerns for the coming school year. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And all of you, just before the break, Tom was talking about standardized testing, and he said, you name it, we take it. I think a lot of teachers feel like there's too much standardized testing. And Bill Murphy, I wonder what you think.
I think that standardized testing is one arrow in the quiver. I think that it is being done because we don't have an alternative. I think that the schools are all different, and therefore they ought to be tailoring their expectations to the local system. But if you don't say what it is that you want to have the students achieve by the end, then you get stuck with the reliance upon the standardized testing. I think that there ought to be a test, there ought to be a goal stated in measurable terms that you could work with. I think that goal should be achieved by working with the staff, the administration, and your community. If you can get those three parts involved in the decision as to what it is that you are looking for, then I don't really care about the standardized testing. The people who pay my bill are basically the people in the local community, and so I want to hear what it is that they want to achieve.
So an argument for more local control over what these assessments are really all about?
It is a very difficult thing, and that's why I don't think it has happened. What you need to do is to specify what it is that you want the students to be doing. And don't tell me that you want better citizens who can compute and write. That doesn't tell me much at all. What
it's
you need to
broad.
Do is do it in a measurable way. And then once you have that, then I think that you are well along the way to a testing. And people say, don't teach to the test. Well, I'm not necessarily in favor of teaching to a standardized test. But if you say this is the goal of our classroom, this is the goal of our school, yeah.
Then the testing's fine because it's related to the goals.
Absolutely.
That you all have worked on. I get it. Tara, how about you?
We've definitely over-tested kids, and they've kind of let us know the effectiveness of it is just not really working anymore. They're not necessarily taking it seriously all the time. So our district is changing.
The kids,
it.
You mean?
Yes. I mean, they've had enough. By the time you've done four kinds of tests in a year, you know, what excuse can you give them that, you know, oh, it just tells us where you are, and it doesn't mean anything to a middle school kid. So we've started going with PACE, which you mentioned, which is Performance Assessment for Competency Education. It's a state initiative for assessment, and it's getting kids to demonstrate student progress that's not just a standardized test. You know, we look at a portfolio of their work. So that's kind of the way that we're headed right now, but we're in the very early stages of it.
Right. This is new. I remember doing a program on this like a year or two ago, I think.
Yes.
So it's just emerging. How about you, Selma? Standardized testing. Here's your chance.
Yes, it is. And here it is. My superiors may or may not like what I have to say, but that's never stopped me from saying it. I have a problem with a one-size-fits-all kind of assessment. Our students learn in different ways. Teachers vary assessment practices, and yet, on the other hand, we're told every student needs to meet this benchmark in this manner. Currently, Manchester is using the SATs, and I understand that the public needs to see what it is that our schools do. But like Tom, I would like to see something more relevant. Not all students are going to be going to colleges, and that's what the SAT is, or Smart or Balanced, or whatever else it is. We're trying to fit every single child in the same peg. That is unconscionable.
Yeah, and I hear you, and I've heard this from a lot of teachers. On the other hand, the argument when No Child Left Behind came out, almost 15 years ago, was, you know, George Bush called it the soft bigotry of low expectations, and the idea that, you know, we need somehow to push schools to help those kids who need help and to, you know, pull everybody up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We all need to be held accountable. The students, the parents, the community, the administrators, the teachers, everyone needs to be held accountable. But it doesn't mean that one test is going to be the measure of that accountability. We have various levels of kinds of things. We do performance assessments in all our classes. We have midterm and final examinations, which are relevant to the work that they're doing. They teach skills as well as content. But that's irrelevant, it seems, in the greater, I don't know, from No Child Left Behind to Common Core to, I don't know, how common is Common Core? And yes, everybody, Tom, needs to be able to speak and to write and to interact. I get that. And some level of numeracy. Absolutely. But not everyone has to do it to the point of achieving a PhD. I still need people who will come to my home and work on my electrical problems that my husband, who is like, you know, the PhD, can't do. And so why are we channeling all of these young people to take that SAT?
But you do want to be careful, though. You don't want to say to, and this has been an issue in Manchester, you don't want to say to, you know, the person who's an English language learner or the person who, you know, comes from a disadvantaged background, well, you're community college material, or you really should consider becoming, you know, a mechanic. Those are honorable places to go to school. Those are honorable professions. But you don't want to assume that certain people are cut out for certain types of work.
That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is that we all, each of us has a set of qualities that distinguish us. And we, as public school educators, should be working on those qualities. We shouldn't be forcing young men and women into an area, a career,
a track,
whatever, that does not work with their lives, with their interest. I mean, you know, they say you can be anything you want to be, and I agree. But I'm teaching English because that's what I love. That's my passion. You know, maybe I would have been okay as a lawyer or an accountant, but my skills were nurtured by teachers who appreciated what I brought. And that's the kind of thing that I wish our schools would continue to do and do more of.
Tom, go ahead.
You take a one-shot test like the Smarter Balance test. The kid who's gone home to a square meal and parents that are helping with their homework and gets a good night's sleep, they're going to be fine on that test. The kid who comes in and has to take that same test on the same day, maybe mom didn't get up to help them get on the school bus. Maybe they didn't have dinner last night. Maybe their parents had a fight. That's in their brains. They're not going to do well on that test. It is not a level playing field.
Well, I've heard that from other teachers. And you kind of hinted at this, Selma, that, you know, these assessment tests are kind of pointed at teachers saying you didn't do your job. But Selma said, and it sounds like you're agreeing, Tom, okay, but, you know, if mom overdosed last night and Johnny had to get his two younger siblings off to school in the morning before he showed up at school to take a test, is it really fair to blame Tom or Bill, the teacher, that Johnny didn't do well?
It's also not equitable in that the Smarter Balance test is a computer test. And some kids have the ability to navigate that very well, and other students don't have that ability. It doesn't mean that they don't necessarily know the information. It's the way they're taking the test isn't...
It's not about content. It's about the way that content is delivered and the way they're expected to deliver their knowledge back. Let's go back to our listeners. And Chris joins us from Nashua. Hello, Chris. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks, Laura.
Sure.
I was speaking with a university professor of engineering actually just yesterday. And what was shared to me is that that person and their colleagues are seeing an alarming slide in the, I guess you could say, the readiness of the students who are coming in nowadays. Like, over the years, what they're seeing is that students are just less and less able to complete projects and do tests because they don't feel they need to actually memorize and know as a fact, you know, factual basis, formulas and how these things are used. Like, they're used to, I don't know where this is coming from, but I guess everything is a click away, or everything is, you know, they don't have to know anything. They just have to be able to go find stuff. And so they're failing on, you know, even if it's the exact same test over years, they're seeing that just the students are having a harder and harder time. Students apparently don't feel that they actually have to know, and they regard teachers, I guess, as just one of many sources of truth. And they'll actually even argue with very experienced professors, you know, very established facts. And so it almost sounds like, you know, we've got functional idiots coming out of high school and they're washing out. They demand do-overs. They demand extra credit. They demand all these things. It's like nobody can fail, at least in their mind.
Well, Chris, lots in this call. And one of the things is something you mentioned earlier, Bill, and you were sort of marveling at the ability of kids to immediately look up facts. On the other hand, Chris says that ability to immediately look up facts, you know, doesn't translate all the time in terms of what people need to know internally without a phone at the ready.
I think, again, if my students are listening out there or ex-students, they will say, oh, Mr. Murphy and his quizzes, I expect them to know a lot of the basic canon. So every night there is homework. You want to talk about homework later. And every day there is a quiz. So I expect that they will have a basic vocabulary in order to talk about historical problems. I share Chris's concern. I think people may have a tendency to make some outlandish statements that they don't have the information in their head to base it upon. In some respects, I refer to this as a computer. Yes, you do need to know the operations of the programs within the computer. But if you don't have good data in it, you're in serious trouble. So it's a combination of be sure that they have, I expect the kids to know. And going back to the assessment, at the first day of class, I will give them a test that this is what I expect on it, and see how they do.
On the first day?
First day. And
okay, so if you're listening, get ready.
And then if I have been successful on the last day in the semester exam, that information will be there again. So I expect them to be able to know something, to be able to write something and to think critically.
All right. Well, Chris, thank you for the call. And Tony in Concord. Go ahead, Tony. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, I'm a teacher in Allenstown. We're a PACE district, and I wanted to just say that I feel like it's such a more meaningful approach to assessing students, whereas standardized testing, it doesn't really give them much of an incentive, or you see students who are often very bright that just do not care, whereas with creating these performance tasks, something that they're actually going to be more excited about, I think just really motivates them more to show their capabilities, whereas standardized testing, it's just a drag on so many kids.
So this is the PACE
that's
that
really the extent of my comment.
Yeah, thank you, Tony. And this is the PACE that Tara mentioned earlier. It's a new way of assessing, a broader portfolio, looking at what kids are doing. Did you want to jump in on that, Bill, real quick?
I have heard around the round table today, I've heard from the callers that there is some concern about the testing. They have expressed limitations. They have expressed different goals. I think it behooves us as educators to come up with the alternative, and I don't know whether I can use the D word on air, but
no, you should not.
fooey with the standardized testing if we all have agreed that this is a better way of going about assessment. Let's go out and do it.
Well, Tony, good luck with the new school year. And a couple emails. Here's one from Aubrey in Concord. I just wonder when society will start to recognize the many, many important hats teachers wear, from doctor to counselor to educator, and start to elect to pay them better. While most great teachers are not financially motivated, Aubrey says, I think the competitive pay is important for attracting and retaining more good teachers, especially because burnout is so high in young teachers. Many teachers, she says, also have huge emotional burdens that they develop in learning to work with traumatized kids. Let's make sure we were treating them well. So, Aubrey, thank you for that email. And that relates to our earlier conversation about all the baggage that some kids are coming to school with.
She needs to run for political office.
Here's another email from Catherine in South Sutton, who says, are you as teachers aware of any cuts to programs, to arts programs at your schools? For example, arts and music education, are they thriving? Is arts integration encouraged? Catherine says, I heard about a school in Frank that had to cut art supplies and a full-time art teacher. Wow, this is a big topic. And Catherine, I want to let you know, next week on The Exchange, we're going to be looking more at what it means to be an artist, how much we care about art in society and in our schools. But does anybody want to take a crack at that? Do you want to, Tara, in Laconia?
We haven't had
arts
a cut
focus?
No, our band and music department is well attended by our students.
Supported.
They really love all the activities that it offers, and we have a really great program going.
And it adds to that sense of school as a community and so forth.
Absolutely.
Selma?
Yes, we haven't seen an appreciable cut anyway. But I will also say that in our music program, is very highly developed. We have some excellent teachers, mentors, and parents who support it. So I think that really is the key. If you have a strong community support for any of these ancillary, inherently important programs, then they stay and they thrive.
Here's a question for you, Tom, and maybe anybody else, although we're running close to the end. There's been so much in the news this week about racism, bigotry, anti-Semitism. How much do you plan to talk to your students about this, Tom?
It's a little bit difficult to talk about in such a homogeneous district. So it probably won't come up a lot. I don't teach social studies. There are other fifth grade teachers that my homeroom will go to in order to do that. And they'll often address that, particularly around Martin Luther King Day, Constitution Day, any number of days. We'll go to some of these issues. But it probably won't come up a lot in my classroom because of the unusual makeup of my district.
Well, and Selma, you're in a diverse school. So what are your sort of thoughts as you approach the school year, given all this upset that we've seen about bigotry, anti-Semitism, racism?
Again, Laura, I rely on literature. Our discussions are literature-based, and from the literature, we can apply it to our world today. And that's really one of the things that I think is most important. We can learn from these things. So I will not go in there and discuss what is going on in the news. That's not my role, really. My role is to have our students appreciate what civil discourse is, to appreciate how we can live our lives to be contributing and nurturing. And I think that once one establishes how the guidelines apply in the classroom, that's modeling.
Modeling and that civil discourse
absolutely
out in the rest of the world. I'm sorry I don't have time to get everybody in on this. I apologize. We could have talked for three more hours. Thank you, everyone, for coming in, and good luck
thank
in the
you
new school year. Really
thank
appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you all.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.